a very brief biographical note, much shorter than the Solzhenitsyn one yesterday. C.S. Lewis died 22 years ago, at the age of 65. He died the same day as President Kennedy, and as Aldous Huxley. And he was born in Northern Ireland in 1898. And his father was a solicitor, and his mother, a clergyman's daughter. And he was a member with his brother of a Unitarian household. He served in the First World War as a young subaltern of 19, and then after the war won a scholarship to Oxford, where he gained a double first. Now, I should explain that a double first means that he got, I don't know how you do it in Australia, in Queensland, a first is the tops, then you get a 2-1 and a 2-2 at Oxford or Cambridge, then you get a third, and below that you don't talk about it at all. Well, he got a first in philosophy, he got a first in English, and then he got a first in classics. So his, his first year got him a double first, and the next year he got a first in classics. So really he gained a triple first. Soon after that, almost after graduating, he became a university lecturer and a college tutor. And in philosophy and later in English literature. He was converted to Christianity while he was at Oxford and was understood by most of his fellow dons, even though his formidable dialectic ability had already become known throughout the entire university at the Socratic Club and in various other ways. And then in particularly early 1940, he gave his first series of public lectures known as Mere Christianity on BBC Radio during the war. In the 1950s, after the war, he married an American lady with two sons and a divorced lady, and then he moved to Cambridge for 9 years, the last 9 years of his life, to a specially created chair in medieval and Renaissance English literature for him at that university. And he returned to Oxford just before his death. It's interesting to note that Lewis, when a boy, wanted to be a poet. And when he was at Oxford, he wanted to be a poet. That was to be his career. And he wrote a great number of stories as a boy, and much poetry. He also wrote hundreds of letters in his own hand to correspondents all around the world. During his lifetime, his books sold phenomenally, and since his death, sales of his books, of his 50 books, run into millions, and C.S. Lewis societies flourish, perhaps the most noteworthy being one at Princeton University. That, in my own opinion, is a mixed blessing, to have societies flourish under your name, because it turns you into a sort of cult figure. Well, so much for a biography of the man. Now let me say something about his achievements, what he set out to do, how he became a Christian, the things he fought against, and the things he stood for. Well, now, Lewis always thought of himself as primarily a writer and a lecturer, in that order. Primarily a scholar who is a writer, and then a lecturer. He liked lecturing, he enjoyed it, and so did his students. But he thought of himself as a scholar who was a writer, and he enjoyed writing enormously. Then he also, of course, gave sermons, but it was as a writer that he saw himself, because whether he was dealing with Christian issues, biblical issues, secular issues, or with literature, he saw himself as a translator. And he says, I am a writer, I do preach sermons, etc., etc., but I'm a translator. I'm a translator of the worldview, the medieval worldview, or the Renaissance worldview. And what I'm trying to do is to put it into language that the man in the street can understand. And this is his great strength as a Christian writer, as a writer who is a Christian, writing about Christian things, that he's able to translate some of the high and lofty ideas that sometimes become abstractions and too metaphysical into common, ordinary, everyday language with homely, as that word is used in England, with warm, homely, well-understood illustrations and symbols. And so the man in the street can come to understand. There is no question about it. One meets person after person who's been not only greatly influenced by C.S. Lewis, but some, of course, quite a number of men and women of my age, I suppose, became Christians from a heathen or secular pagan background because of, as a result of his writings. They were the they were the road along which they walked until they came to God in Christ. Turned them round. He succeeded in turning Christian vernacular into Christian traditional writing into the vernacular, into the language of the man in the street. He also did another thing in this area of writing, which I think is important. He made Christian books popular. Christian bookshops as such did not exist in the 40s or the 50s, and as far as I can remember, even in the 60s, but they may have done in the 60s. But he made Christian books popular. And the great thing about Lewis, C.S. Lewis, is that you find him not only in Christian books, but, mercifully, in non-Christian bookshops. And, that's such a good thing. Far more important to have him there than it is in these Christian bookshops. Now, he's always thought of by most people as the author. If you remember nothing else about C.S. Lewis, people say, oh, didn't he write some stories for children? Yes, he did. And they're called the Narnia stories. They're fantasy stories. And he saw fantasy as being the way in which he could write. Now, there's two ways, or maybe more ways, but there's only two ways that I know of in which you can write a story. You can write the Once Upon a Time, and that immediately captures our interest. It's a one-liner that is bound to arrest our attention, because everybody likes a story. And it can become either a novel or fantasy. Now, if you're writing fantasy, if you're writing a novel, we all know what a novel is. You set it in the 18th century or set it in the 20th century, and people do and say the things according to the centuries in which they are, and they don't move in any other form of reality. But if you're writing fantasy, you will introduce animals and trees, and as well as human beings. But the animals and the trees will not only be animals and trees that you talk about or write about, but those animals will talk, and those trees will walk. And that's fantasy. It becomes an allegory in the end. It becomes an allegory. That is picture language, role after role of a role of film, as it were, in words, is conveying truth. Well, you can do this if you write plain fiction or novel. You can do that just as easily. But he deliberately chose fantasy. I suppose one reason why was because he liked it from the age of five. He wrote his first story at the age of 5 years old. It was a little book called To Mars and Back, which has a delightful thought about it. You go to Mars and you come back again on Earth. And it shows his interest in so-called space adventures. Well, now, he chose fantasy because he thought that fantasy could more easily carry the things he wanted to say. And he was convinced that fantasy can carry philosophical, psychological, metaphysical, moral, and Christian cargo. It can carry all those things. Because, one, everybody likes a story. Two, fantasy enriches stories. If, for example, you in your country or in mine, we go a walk in the woods in springtime, in England we see the bluebells and the sunlight dappling through the trees, and there are primroses and little scurryings and birdsong. That's beautiful. We mustn't worship it, worship the creator of it, but it is beautiful and we enjoy it. Now, if we then, after reading one of C.S. Lewis, any one of those Narnia stories, we next go into a wood, we find it far more enchanting than before. Because we think of those trees as walking, and when their leaves are brushing each other in the wind, they're talking to each other. And when we see a little squirrel, we think of him, oh yes, he is a squirrel hunting for nuts, but underneath, underneath the ground, there is a house in which Mrs. Squirrel is preparing his tea and putting his slippers out for him to put on as he toasts his toes on by the fire. In other words, fantasy enriches reality. It is not a substitute for, but it enriches. So the next time you walk through that wood is even more wonderful than it was before. That's another reason why Lewis chose fantasy, and why those of you who write or like to write, hope to write, may well find that that is a form that you can that you find attractive, in which you can happily work. But of course, it'll have its problems. Another reason that he wanted to impress upon people is that fantasy is just as real as reality, just as real as stories, just as real as reality. In one sense, of course, in a general sense, it isn't. But if you've made it real within the world you're describing, then it's true to reality. Now, if we were to have talking trees that did ridiculous or very bizarre, crazy things, we'd say, well, no, that doesn't even happen in the real world. But Lewis never does that. He keeps the fantasy within the bounds of fantasy stroke reality. And, of course, perhaps the most important historical reason, certainly from a point of view of literary history, is that fantasy is a much older form of storytelling. Once upon a time, and we're caught. We want to know more. Yes, I mentioned that he wrote his first story at the age of five. And he and his brother Warren, who was a major in the army, they joined together when they were boys to write a number of stories together. Now, certain truths emerge. Let's talk about these Narnia stories just for a little bit. Certain truths emerge in the Narnia stories and in the three in the trilogy of trilogy set in space. No truths are imposed, or rather no morals are imposed. They grow out of the story. They grow out of the story. You have man's association with the rest of creation. That's absolutely clear. When you walk through this wood a second time after having read Lewis, you're far more sensitive to and aware of, sensitive to and understand a little more about a squirrel or a tree or a daffodil. Man's association, not his relationship with it. We can't have a relationship with nature, but we do have an association with it. We too are part of it. We are apart from it, but we are a part of it. And man's association with nature and his responsibility to the rest of creation within a real framework, a realistic framework, is made clear to us through these stories. Then there are vivid descriptions. A great deal of wisdom is distilled. Truths, with a small t and s on the end, truths emerge. The reality of evil is made clear. It is judged and it is defeated. The existence of good is made equally clear. The nature of faith is shown. And the consequences of faith are outlined. Also, there's a great deal of childlikeness, not childishness. One doesn't expect childishness in maturity. But we do lose an enormous amount as adults if we ever lose some of the childlike qualities, such as a sense of wonder. If every time you and I look at a sunset, we say, or somebody draws our attention to it, we say, oh yes, I saw it yesterday. Or, yeah, I'm sure it's beautiful, yes, but I've got some work to do. Or, oh, this wretched snow. It's all the same. We've lost our sense of wonder, and we are the poorer. Wordsworth and Blake, among others, show us that in their sort of pantheistic way before they began to write more Christianly. Don't lose your sense of wonder. Clearly, C.S. Lewis never lost his, otherwise he could never, never have written those Narnia stories or the Space Trilogy either. Allegory. What is allegory? Well, allegory is using using animals or trees or whatever to point up truths. And so you have fantasy and allegory, also myth, which draws on, Tolkien, of course, draws on it much more. Icelandic and Norse and Anglo-Saxon myths, Tolkien in his work draws on those much more. But to some extent, there is that sort of background framework for Lewis in the Space Trilogy. Let me now say a little how he became a Christian, or rather, why he became a Christian. The how doesn't particularly matter with any of us, but why he became a Christian. Well, he was greatly influenced, and this goes reminds us of Solzhenitsyn and of T.S. Eliot. He had a great friend in Northern Ireland, a fellow schoolboy called Arthur Greaves, and he was a Christian. And this lad never deviated from his Christian faith, and it matured and grew intellectually and spiritually. And that was a great encouragement to Lewis. At the time, it was a great invitation, and he tried to shake his friend's belief up to when he went to Oxford and the other lad went to the University of Belfast. But Greaves wasn't shaken. But it was not only the things they talked about, it was the life that this boy lived. He wasn't a goody-goody, but there was something different about him. And again, as I say, you see it with Solzhenitsyn and others, and let's hope, please God, that people notice it in our lives. They say, we're not better than other people, but we're different. Not different in the wrong sense, or in the crazy sense, but there's something different about us. And Lewis noticed this with Arthur Greaves. That was an early influence. The whole influence of home, of course, was against it. His father was rather arid and dry, and a Unitarian, and mother was more sensitive. But there was nothing there much at home to help him. Then when he got to Oxford, he began to read very widely, and he was a voracious reader, of course, and some of the books that he read reinforced his agnostic, atheistic beliefs. But others disturbed his atheistic beliefs. And here are intelligent people writing, and this disturbs me. Well, being the man he was, he had to come to terms with that and reckon, well, maybe. Then he began to read the Scottish mystical fantasist George MacDonald, writing at the end of last century. And here again, he was influenced by this writing. And MacDonald was talking Christian truths in fantasist terms. And this helped Lewis also. Another thing which we share with him, although not necessarily under this name, was what he called a longing for joy. What Dr. Schaefer used to call the mannishness of man in every man, whether he's a sophisticated playboy in his penthouse in Manhattan in New York, or whether he's a little pygmy running around in a loincloth in a steaming Amazonian jungle, we all share the same moral mannishness, the same mannishness. There is conscience. There is the looking out on the external world and seeing its glory and its form and its purpose. Some grasping something of that. But there is also a longing for something better than this world. And there's a longing within ourselves to be better than we are. Lewis called that a longing for joy. And he never found it until he became a Christian. And then it was as though it was like a bud, and it grew into the flower and became something very strong and beautiful in his life. Then he honestly did, as we all should do, examine himself. And as he writes repeatedly, he was not pleased with what he saw inside himself. He was aware of sin and of failure. And finally, as a lecturer, around about the age of 30, he began to meet like-minded men. He began to meet men who were Christian men and who nailed their colours to the mast and were not ashamed of so doing. Men like the professor of modern English literature at Oxford at that time, Neville Coghill. the professor of Icelandic and Anglo-Saxon literature, J.R.R. Tolkien, a university lecturer in law, Owen Barfield, a woman, writer of detective stories, who was a brilliant classicist and taught at Oxford for a short time, Dorothy Sayers, Charles Williams, a reader for the Oxford University Press, reading manuscripts, who was a Christian with whom he came in contact. And he came to the conclusion, these are bright guys. They've thought it through. I better really think about it. And he went to Whipsnade Zoo, which is an open-air zoo, a great big park zoo, and on a bus one day, and thinking about these things, and he writes that when he got into Whipsnade Park Zoo, he knew he was a Christian. He certainly had believed in God. He came to Christ, as it were, through God. Well, we better not get into that. That's another issue, whether it's Christ or God. But anyway, he came to Christ through God. He came to see that God was there, the triune God, not the Unitarian God, who's no God at all. But the triune God was really there. And then he moved on. Now, the most important book that he considered his is The Abolition of Man. And it's not surprising. Because in that book, he attacks a number of things. And being the scholar he was, you find this in the preaching, for example, in the work of a man like Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. Always when he preached, he would take us back into history and lay the historical foundation, and then move on to negative aspects, and then to positive aspects, and then to the conclusion. Lewis does exactly the same. And negatively, he is attacking all the horrible things which is making our century seem so hideous. Reductionism, determinism, subjectivism, scientism, the belief that technology is the escalator to the millennium, that it is sacred, it's the sacred cow of the 20th century. He attacks and demolishes that futility. Progressivism, materialism, he attacks all those things. He doesn't merely attack them and say, these things are futile and wrong. I mean, that's futile and stupid to do that. He gives reasons why. And then he speaks for. He speaks for a vital literary tradition, the sort of tradition I was trying to talk about this morning, stemming from the Judeo-Christian tradition in Western literature. He speaks for that. Maybe he nails his Christianity too close to that in cultural terms, but this is what he does. He speaks for traditional values. He speaks for the let me give you an exact tell you exactly what he does speak for in that particular book. He defends the common reader and his potential for growth through literature, not for redemption, but for growth in understanding. He maintained that literature is always an arrangement of what is already there. It's never newly creative, per se. Its strength is to fortify those things we already, within ourselves, recognize as boundaries or guidelines. And it is an endowment and an endorsement of everyday life when it's real literature. It gets us used to people who are represented as subjects, not as objects. Bad literature describes emotions, but good literature presents situations that create the appropriate emotions in the reader. Then one more thing, he says, and he takes these sideswipes at people, very lovingly, but very honestly, and with great scholarship behind him. He talks about those people who assert that such and such a book is out of date. Well, now, I can understand Peter Ravenscroft saying, well, this book really is out of date. Medical technology has moved on from here. But he will still have things to learn from that book. But you see, in the In the modern climate of opinion in universities and academia generally, as you are, some of you are familiar, professors and lecturers will poo-poo a whole range of literature from the past. They poo-poo Shakespeare if they had the nerve. A whole lot of books from the past. Saying, well, that's out of date. You've got to look at it from the progressive view. We've moved on historically from there. We're in a Marxist thinking or Freudian thinking. Sure, you've been listening to my lectures for the last year to know that. That sort of thing. And these dear people, every one of them made in the image of God, have this tremendous sense of progressivism that we're really moving forward. Man is coming to greater and greater understanding. We must put aside all these old books. What is Lewis' answer to that? See, what those men are really saying is they're really uttering slogans, sloganizing in sentences. But what Lewis says is, now, come on, face up to why we should jettison this literature, this textbook, this commentary from the past. Ask these questions. Why has it gone out of date? Not it's gone out of date, but why has it gone out of date? Secondly, why is it said to be discredited? Thirdly, was it ever refuted? If so, by whom? If so, where? Who did it? Somebody who's not qualified to speak professionally? If so, how conclusively? Did it merely die away, as fashions do? If the latter, that tells us nothing about its truth or falsehood. Isn't that marvellous thinking? It's so clear, so crystally clear. So he speaks for and he speaks against in that book, and he gives us a terrible warning. A warning way back in 1959 or so. He gave those lectures at Durham University, and we're seeing all that he wrote come to fruition. Incidentally, he wrote science fiction long before the term was current. Now, what are his particular achievements? He wrote poetry. He didn't write any plays. He wrote novels, fantasy novels. He also, there is his tremendous Christian output. But also, we have to think of scholars, C.S. Lewis, not as a cult figure, not as somebody we can appeal to and use and stand behind, or Schaeffer or any of these great men, stand behind them and say, well, you fight your battles for me. Here's a well-known figure. He speaks up for me. We can say that. We can say that. And we can thank God for men like Lewis and others. But he must be seen... he must be seen not so much as a Christian apologist. That's the way we might like to want to see him. He must be seen as a great scholar. He was the foremost medieval and Renaissance English literature scholar of his day and for many years since. And nothing that he has written in terms of his English scholarship has ever been refuted. Nothing. He's as respected today as ever. What are his achievements? Scholarship. Making Christianity easier for the man in the street to understand and to think about. Endorsing values that are really true. They're not middle class. They're true values. They're what God has given. Values such as honesty. And not only honesty, but being known as an honorable man as well as an honest man. Values of that kind, endorsing those values and showing how they've always been recognized in great literature. This is one reason why he hated modern literature. He felt it was so untrue to what life is, to the reality of life. And he's right in most cases. On the other hand, he was able to see that so much of it clearly is paralleling and acting as a mirror for the fall and telling the truth about man, although the writers are not aware of that. Another achievement of his is to write and to live friendship. He was a great friend, and he was much admired as a friend of others. Every vacation, university vacations, he'd go stumping across the English countryside, in a car or a train and then walk and walk and walk with Coghill and and Tolkien and others. He was generous with his time and with his money. 2/3 of the royalties from all his books went into a fund for needy authors or for struggling undergraduates. Nobody knew who received it, where the money came from. He was a splendid lecturer. People from all faculties cut their lectures to go to hear C.S. Lewis. And this is just a little homely aside. He would come in and walk up the steps to this great big lecture hall. They always had to give him the biggest lecture room because he filled it, or it was filled. And as he came up the steps with his gown halfway down his shoulders, he'd already have started his lecture, and he'd walk up the aisle and onto the rostrum and continue non-stop, and then the buzzer would go, and he'd still be talking, walk out of the aisle, and talking his way down the steps there. He had so much to say. yes. Well, those are some of the things. He had a phenomenal memory. If you gave him just 2 or 3 words of quotation, he would be able to tell you, so suppose it was in Paradise Lost, complete the quotation for you, give you 100 lines before and a couple of 100 after, I'm not exaggerating, tell you what book it was in, the number of the line. Had a phenomenal memory. A great big library in his rooms in Magdalen College in Oxford and Magdalen College in Cambridge. He'd know what was in every book. He'd read every book, or skimmed every book and absorbed it all. Had phenomenal memory. What are some of his failures? Well, no, let me give one or two more achievements. He believed in the exclusivity of objective truth, which is another way of saying that he believed in God as absolute truth. There's nothing relative about Christian truth. He knew. It is absolute, and God, if we call God absolute truth, that is a cold term, but it's perhaps the right way to start thinking about God. There's nothing relative, it's absolute. The exclusivity of objective truth and scripture. He was an unashamed supernaturalist. There is an unseen world. There is a spiritual battle going on in the heavenlies. And the Screwtape Letters show his awareness of that. And he had great trouble writing that, as you probably know. He felt that his mouth was full of dust and grit and ashes every time he put pen to paper. And he never felt well when he was writing it. You can draw your own conclusions from that. He saw an unbridgeable gulf between truth and falsehood. An unbridgeable gulf. And as I said about Solzhenitsyn, he didn't care two hoots about what is new. He was concerned only for what is true. Now, what are some of his failures? He disliked T.S. Eliot's poetry. He didn't dislike T.S. Eliot, but they met and they discussed this. But when I say he disliked his poetry, he could not see T.S. Eliot's poetic achievement. And lots of people have been unable to see T.S. Eliot's poetic achievement too. He is difficult. Nobody's going to say he's easy. But Lewis had a sort of blind spot there. He disliked most or much modern literature. Maybe he tied Christianity, as I hinted earlier, too much into a particular epoch of our literary tradition, namely from Shakespeare perhaps up to the end of the 17th century. He was insufficiently clear, from a biblical point of view, on the authority of Scripture. He seemed to find no trouble with accepting the New Testament as wholly inspired, wholly authoritative, and even inerrant. And he saw the Old Testament as authoritative, but he felt he wasn't too happy about some of the miracles and so on in the Old Testament. He played a bit fast and loose with the Old Testament. Nevertheless, he had a biblical worldview. Now, let us not forget that. He believed in purgatory and in prayers for the dead, and he found his denominational affiliation. He found himself happiest in the Church of England, but in the High Church tradition, the Anglo-Catholic tradition. It is possible to see that if he hadn't been a Christian, I do think he'd have been a pantheist. it's possible to see that he gets very close in the book which he entitles Miracles to deifying nature. He doesn't do so, but he gets perilously close to it. Now, what else can I say about him? Just one or two perhaps little personal things about him. At Oxford, he was greatly disliked. He was loved very much, liked very much as a young lecturer. But the moment he became a Christian, he was in trouble with the establishment. At a place like Oxford, and usually a place like Cambridge, indeed academia anywhere nowadays, of course, I'm talking about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it was all right to view Christianity as objective, as an objective philosophy that you could examine and it could stand up with other philosophies. But, my dear man, you really aren't going to practice this, surely. And Lewis made it clear that he was. And it did change his life, as it's intended to. And his fellow dons were disturbed by this, and they ostracized him, and they formed themselves into a cabal and prevented his getting the chair of English literature at Oxford, which he richly deserved with his academic qualifications and achievements behind him. But he was very, very happy at Cambridge. Perhaps those days were over, and perhaps the word had gone to Cambridge, don't treat this man the way they did him at Oxford. And he spent nine very happy years there. And there were no problems when he was professor there. He loved walking and music, and he loved conversation. He didn't enjoy talking. People nowadays don't engage in conversation, they just talk. But he enjoyed conversation. He saw it as an art. He had a formidable mind with rigorous logic behind it. And he, along with others, was responsible, as you know, for founding the Inklings. Maybe we could have a question on that to save some my time, so that you have more time. One final thing. I do think that we should regret his having become a cult figure. In the United States, there are two Christian colleges that claim to have the wardrobe through which the children walked into Narnia. There is another Christian college that has his desk and various pipes belonging to him that he smoked. And all this is as near as you can possibly get in the 20th century to buying relics in medieval England and touting them round from one monastery to another. I think the whole business is thoroughly disgusting. There are actors in the United States who for $2,000 to $3,000 will do impersonations of C.S. Lewis. Perhaps that's not too bad. But the ultimate indignity, I think, is an animated film of the Narnia stories.